Hello and welcome to this podcast summary of the IASB-FASB joint board meeting held between the 17th and the 20th of April 2012. Joined today by Steve Cooper, member of the IASB, and Alan Teixeira, senior director of technical activities. Hello gentlemen.
Hello.
Hi.
Alan, perhaps we could start with you, if you could tell us about the discussions that took place regarding classification and measurement.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Mark. Essentially, the ISB said that they would reopen IFRS 9, at least for a very limited review of that, to see if there was any way we could bridge the differences between us and the FASB. The first two things that we had a look at this month were quite important issues. One was the business model as the basis for assessing whether or not amortized cost classification should be used, and the other was bifurcation of financial assets and financial liabilities. So if we have a look at the business model to start with, basically the boards agreed that financial assets would qualify for amortized cost if the assets are held within a business model with the objective of holding the assets in order to collect the contractual cash flows. Now, those of you familiar with IFRS 9 will essentially see that captures the concepts that we have there already. So for us, it's no change. And it's a move for the FASB because they've agreed that amortized cost would be appropriate on those basis. Now, I just need to, I guess, qualify that slightly. It was a very narrow vote for the FASB. It was a 4-3 in favour of that particular decision. But it essentially means that there wouldn't be a change in classification for IFRS as we go through the sort of convergence process.
I think it's important, Alan, to just point out that there may be some additional guidance, clarifications that might be necessary to IFRS 9, so it may not leave the wording entirely unchanged, but certainly the underlying concepts, as you highlight, would remain in place for IFRS 9.
That's right, and of course there's some experience that people have got in terms of preparing for IFRS 9 that would be helpful for that process. The other thing is bifurcation of financial assets and financial liabilities. Those again familiar with IFRS 9, essentially we don't allow bifurcation of financial assets that contain cash flows that are not solely principal and interest. In other words, they've got some sort of embedded derivative in there. Essentially they get classified at fair value through profit or loss, so we don't allow the separation of those components. But for liabilities or financial liabilities, when people use the fair value option, we do allow bifurcation, and that's mainly to deal with what we call the own credit problem, where when people have got their own debt, changes in value, and we take the own credit component out, and that gets put through OCI. Well, essentially, the ISB confirmed that we're going to retain that, and the FASB also agreed to have that same model as well. Because initially, I think the FASB had been proposing a model where they would bifurcate both assets and liabilities. So essentially, it's good news again for us because it won't be a change for those applying IFRS 9.
Okay, well, it sounds like a fair amount of progress made there on classification and measurement. Let's stay with financial instruments. Steve, if you could talk a little bit about the discussions on impairment.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. We looked at three areas of impairment: the expected loss estimates, calculating a lifetime loss, the bucket one measurement approach, and then trade receivables. All of these are areas that we have discussed previously, and a lot of the meeting was more to do with clarification and reconfirmation rather than breaking new ground. On the expected loss estimates, we're dealing here with a lifetime loss, and the boards agreed about the general principles of how that lifetime loss should be calculated. So, for example, we specified that all reasonable supportable information should be considered in making the forward-looking estimate. You should take into account the range of possible outcomes and the likelihood of reasonableness of those outcomes. And the purpose of that particular factor is to emphasize that it's not the most likely outcome that determines an expected loss, that you would have to take into account the range of possible outcomes. So if, for example, there is a certain probability of default, but that probability is relatively small, you can't say, well, because that's a small probability, then I'll go with the most likely outcome, which is that something will be repaid. You do have to take into account the probability, maybe it's a 10% probability, 20%, whatever, that the default might occur, and then base a lifetime loss estimate on that probability-weighted basis. and also to confirm that the time value of money would be included in the calculation of that lifetime loss.
I know we discussed quite a bit about what reasonable and supportable information was, Steve, in terms of how hard do you have to try to get the information?
I think the board is aware that we mustn't require people to go on a detailed fishing expedition to try and identify, you know, every last bit of information. And quite clearly, the further out you go, the less information you're going to have to support a particular forecast. And that's why we fully expect and agree with that the further out you go, the more you would rely upon historical loss rate type information. Whereas for a more of a short-term forecast, you can certainly then make more specific reference to forecasts and current economic conditions and these types of forecasts.
So it's really, we've got a sort of an undue cost and effort overlay in here to make sure that people aren't put into, have a burden put on them that's disproportionate, I think, with the information they would be getting out of that search.
No, that's exactly the case. So the second issue we looked at was the bucket one measurement. There's been some confusion perhaps about exactly what the objective was behind this. And the idea is that it is the expected cash shortfalls for the lifetime of a financial asset where a default event is expected within the next 12 months. So it's a 12-month forward-looking expected loss amount, but it's focused upon situations where there is an expectation of that loss event happening within the 12 months. We did emphasise that there could be a variety of approaches that could be used to calculate this amount. So that might, for example, include a loss rate type methodology or a PDLGD type methodology. So we're not going to be specific about exactly what method should be used, but we're going to try and emphasise that the principle of what that bucket one measure is trying to capture.
Okay, so just to clarify, Steve, I think some of the confusion there was that when we talked about a 12 months of expected losses, some people read that to be the cash shortfall over the next 12 months, but it's not that, is it? It's more the event itself, is that right?
No, that's right. It is where you have an event with expected within the next 12 months, so default, and then it is the lifetime losses that you would expect in respect of those assets for which a default event is expected to occur in the next 12 months. And then the third one is trade receivables. We reconfirmed at this meeting that we would apply an expected loss model to trade receivables. Where these don't have a significant financing component, they would go straight into bucket two. If they do have a significant financing component, it would be the application of the model in the normal manner. We emphasized as part of this that some of the practical expedients which are currently used, like a provision matrix, will still be applicable. We don't anticipate that the model we're developing will actually have a significant impact on the way in which provisioning is done for trade receivables. It is not the intention to burden the non-financial companies with significant change in an area which, frankly, there isn't much of an issue in practice.
Yeah, and I think the boards both saw that there was more of a risk or a danger in creating an exception for accounts receivable than there was in the fact, and just dealing with this through practical experience, as Steve said, the reality is we're going to end up with very similar accounting to that we have today.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Let's stay with you, Steve, if we may. I believe there was discussion on insurance as well.
Yes, we had a number of areas covered. Some of these were pretty detailed technical issues and really developing further some of these areas that we discussed before, so particularly reinsurance and some of the more detailed provisions that you find within insurance policies. But then we had two sessions, education sessions, on the single margin and other comprehensive income, which perhaps have slightly more wider implications than the first two issues that I mentioned. I'm not going to go through the detail of reinsurance and policy loans contract modifications. There's a very detailed summary within update, Also, the insurance team do a separate insurance podcast where they will go through these things in more detail. I mean, it covered things like retroactive insurance contracts, for example, and the period over which the single margin or the residual margin should be recognised. It also covered whether in reinsurance contracts you should use the premium allocation approach and the building block approach. The ISB and FASB had a slightly different approach to that based upon the differences in the decisions that we previously made about the use of these two methodologies. But quite detailed specific issues, and as I said, I'm not going to go through the real detail of the decisions that were taken there. What I will say, though, is about these two education sessions, which actually only merit a very short mention within update, and that was largely because no decisions were taken by either the ISB or the FASB. The first one is to do with the single margin methodology that the FASB has for recognising profits on insurance contracts. You'll recall that the ISB has the methodology of a risk adjustment with a residual margin. The FASB don't have, in their tentative decisions, they don't have a risk adjustment and instead have a single margin. And the FASB gave the ISB an education session on the development and status of their single margin approach. The reason for that is to see whether there is any basis on which we might reach further convergence in this area. I mean, there is a lot of similarity between what we're doing. In both cases, it's essentially how you recognize the profit on an insurance contract over the life of that contract. The FASB approach refers to risk on the basis of that being important in deciding how you run off such a margin. They would recognize profit, recognize margin on the basis of release from risk. The ISB, on the other hand, has more of an explicit use of risk within actually measuring a risk adjustment, and then that risk adjustment gets remeasured each period, which kind of mirrors the runoff on the FASB approach, but adds in some additional factors like what happens if risk goes up, then the ISB margin would rise, whereas the FASB margin wouldn't. So there's lots of similarity, there's also significant differences. So the ISB had an education session on this, and we will be thinking more in the future about whether there's any way in which we might get together and reduce some of the differences in this area. I would say, however, that there was a lot of support for the risk adjustment approach from the ISB constituents. So just because we are having an education session doesn't necessarily mean that any changes are going to be made to our current decisions. The other one was a session on the use of other comprehensive income within insurance. Many insurers have called on us to make use of other comprehensive income to deal with some of the volatility issues that arise in insurance, particularly making use of OCI for changes in the discount rate on insurance liabilities. They say that we should be using that on the liability side and also reopening decisions in IFRS 9 on the asset side to make use of OCI for certain fair value changes for assets that are held by insurance entities. So this is an area that we need to think about in the context of the reopening of IFRS 9 that Alan talked about earlier, but also in the context of insurance liabilities. So we had a discussion this month about the potential to use OCI for insurance liabilities, the advantages, disadvantages of doing that, how it might work, whether there should be recycling or not, the need for a loss adequacy test and the like. And then next month, we will debate this together with the related issues in IFRS 9 about the use of a fair value OCI category. Obviously, it's important that we do this together because of the interaction between the insurance project and IFRS 9.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Alan, perhaps if I could come back to you just to wrap up any other topics that were discussed during the meeting.
Sure, thanks, Mark. A couple of things. We had an annual improvements issue that came up about revenue-based depreciation. And that will appear, it'll be quite a while yet, but it'll appear in the next cycle of annual improvements. But an update interpretations committee, of course, anybody can get the IFRS interpretations committee update off our website as well. It has all the details. The more substantive issue was investment entities. We have an exposure draft that was out for comment. The comment period is now closed, and that's the possibility of introducing an exception to consolidations for what we call investment entities or investment companies, as they're often called. And we essentially went through the comment letter summary this time, so it didn't make any decisions, but the staff had analysed all the comments received. And we've been working with the FASB on this jointly, and at the moment we're sort of setting out a timetable, and the idea is to try and get the substantive decisions resolved by July of this year, so that we can move ahead with that project.
Okay. And of course, there was a trustees meeting as well, not last week, but the week before, and extensive discussions with the Due Process Oversight Committee. So I believe we're planning to publish for public comment the changes to the Due Process Handbook.
Yeah, over the last 18 months or so, the Due Process Oversight Committee has built up a protocol for dealing with comments, and also for how it actually, I guess, supervises our activities and provides much more active oversight than it might have done historically. Those oversight procedures, including how we report not just to the Due Process Oversight Committee, but report throughout the life cycle of a project, have been built into a redraft of our Due Process Handbook. And the handbook we expect to put out for public comment. If the trustees approve it, there's a meeting scheduled for next week for them to have a look at that. And if they approve that, it'll follow shortly after that.
One to look out for. Good. Okay, well, thank you, gentlemen, for your time. That just leaves me to give the obligatory health warning that these are the personal views of the presenters and not necessarily the views of the IASB. The official summary of the board meeting is provided by IASB Update, which will be available from the IASB website shortly. Thank you very much.